today on the Run to the Top podcast.
The more pain or discomfort you expect to feel and accept, the more you'll actually be able to handle. And your performance in a race is going to be determined in part by how much you're willing to suffer. And you just will be willing to suffer more if ahead of time you braced yourself for it and said, hey, I know it's coming, no big deal.
Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast from Runners Connect, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. Together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now here's your host, Sinead Hockey.
Hey guys, this is Sinead back with you again for this latest episode of Run to the Top, brought to you by Runners Connect. I hope you're having a wonderful day and that this podcast makes it even better. Last week we spoke with registered dietitian and running coach Heather Kaplan. Heather's not your typical dietitian. She doesn't believe in diets and argues diet culture is detrimental to both our well-being and mentality towards food. Instead, Heather helps runners relearn intuitive eating that helps them listen to their bodies and eat the way they as individuals need to eat. We also talked about orthorexia, which is a lesser known but extremely common condition among runners in which a fixation on healthy eating can cause negative side effects. You heard that right. Too much healthy eating can actually be unhealthy. It was a pretty eye-opening interview, so be sure to check it out if you missed it. On to this week's episode. Later this month, we're hosting a weekend-long summit on mental training, and we've invited 14 of the sport's leading experts in running and its relationship with the mind. One of our speakers is author, coach, and nutritionist Matt Fitzgerald, who has written several books and articles on the psychology of running, including his very popular book, How Bad Do You Want It? Mastering the Psychology of Mind Over Muscle. Today, Matt will discuss what all goes into a runner's mental capacity and share with us some tips as to how we can better push our limits. And if you like what you hear and you want to hear more, you can sign up for the free summit at runnersconnect.net/mental-summit. The summit will begin November 17th and run through November 19th, 2017. And I will say once it's over, there is a small fee to access the archived version, so make sure to sign up fast. And one more thing, at the end of today's show, I'll be revealing the winners of our last giveaway and also announcing a new giveaway, so be sure to stick around. As usual, after a quick break, we'll be right back with our interview. On this week's episode, we're actually sponsoring ourselves. If you're looking for a custom training plan, coaching support, and an amazing team of supportive, like-minded runners, head on over to runnersconnect.net/train. There, you can start your free 2-week trial and add your name to the nearly 1,000 fellow runners we've helped achieve new personal bests. Again, that's runnersconnect.net/train. We hope you join us. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Glad to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you. Matt, we were just talking a little bit before the interview, but I interviewed you for our nutrition summit a few months back, and I know you wear a lot of hats. You're a nutritionist, you're an author, and you're a coach. And so today I do want to talk to you a little bit more about what you've written. And so first off, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. So I've been an athlete most of my life. I started running when I was 11. I'm 46 now and still at it. Done a bunch of triathlons too, but not in a while. Been coaching since 2001. Writing about running and other endurance sports since 1995. So this is my shtick. This is what I do. I don't plan to change it.
Awesome. Well, no, I think you found your calling for sure here. So Matt, one book in particular that I do want to talk to you about, it's one of your more recent books, is called How Bad Do You Want It? And it's a book all about the psychology of running. So can you tell us a little bit about this book and what prompted you to write it?
Yeah, you know, I've always been fascinated by the psychological dimension of running ever since. Actually, I talk about this in the book, but the first, you know, endurance race I ever did was in the fifth grade. It was just, you know, like a field day type of thing for the fifth grade. It was roughly a mile race around some soccer fields. And I just remember being, you know, kids like to run, but kids sprint, you know, kids don't, kids don't voluntarily do long distance races, you know, unless their teachers make them. Mm-hmm. And I just remember being blown away by the type of suffering that was involved. You know, it was just something new to my experience. And, you know, I won the race, but it was very painful. And I just came away from it. My dad was a runner. So I sort of felt like it was in the family. I had an interest in it. You know, winning feels good. So it made me want to do more. But even from that first experience, I had a sense that this sport was all about that suffering and your ability to, you know, to face it. And, you know, obviously it's about heart and lungs and legs as well. But I've never really changed my mind about that. And then as a high school runner, I really struggled with the mental side of the sport and ended up actually quitting and not running in college because I just, I guess I couldn't really, I felt like I couldn't dig as deep as some of the other top runners in my state. I grew up in the small state of New Hampshire. I was one of the better runners and I just couldn't make the jump to the next level. And it was just because, quite honestly, I was mentally weak or mentally unprepared, mentally unfit. So when I got back into running later, I really wanted to work on that and sort of see myself as a different way. I wanted my mind to be a strength versus a weakness. And it just so happens there's a lot of really interesting research going on. It's kind of a breakthrough era in understanding how the role of the brain and the mind in endurance sports. And there's a lot of cool you know, discoveries being made, progress being made in terms of, you know, the practical applications of those discoveries. So that's why I wanted to write this book, because I felt like I'm not the only one who struggles or who has struggled with the psychological dimension of the sport. And there are answers out there. You know, there's the science sort of explains what the nature of the challenge really is in ways that even if you're not well versed in neuropsychology, you can still sort of understand it as an athlete and then, you know, benefit from all that stuff that's going on.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, I think it's safe to say running and endurance sports in general are probably the most mentally difficult out there. And so a lot of our listeners are really going to find that this interview hits home, I think, because it's just such a difficult sport mentally. But Matt, you've written several times on this. You actually wrote an article called How Resilience Beats Talent for a Competitive Edge. And I want to talk to you about that as well. So in this article, you argue that greater mental capacity can make up for lesser physical capacity. And there's a bunch of evidence now that proves this. So can you talk about that evidence a little bit here?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, that's absolutely the case that aspects of your psychology, as well as physiological attributes, determine your success in a race. So the physical stuff is obvious and we've known about for a long time. You know, if you're fast, you're more likely to win. If you have a high VO2 max, you're more likely to win. But so what some of the newer psychological research is showing is that if you're confident, you're more likely to win. If you're passionate, you're more likely to win. So there's studies being done now where, you know, athletes are just sitting down and filling out questionnaires or doing computer tests to gain insight into their psychological characteristics, their mental traits. And some of these characteristics and traits that are purely psychological and are tested in street clothes, you know, on a computer, they're as predictive of success in endurance racing as something like a VO2 max test, which is, pardon the pun, kind of mind blowing if you're, you know, if you have that traditional perspective, which is very sort of physiologically oriented. You know, it's all about the body. And that's really, you know, it's we have proof now that is not the case. So there was one recent study. So it can be positive and negative. So there was a study done involving Chilean age group triathletes a couple of years ago, and they found that those who tested high for anxiety tended to perform less. So just, you know, in a large pool of, you know, amateur triathletes, those who were highly anxious just didn't perform as well. Irrespective of anything else, any other factors like age, gender, whatever. And then, you know, some of the ones that on the flip side, there are other characteristics that are performance enhancing, like pain tolerance. You can just sit a bunch of people down and give them, you know, non-lethal pain tolerance tests. And those will be highly predictive of endurance performance. I check the research almost weekly, and there's something new, mm-hmm. Almost every time I check.
That's amazing. So kind of going off of that, kind of talking about those traits that they've found in the athletes that are, they're known to really perform, the best mentally in races. One of those traits that you spoke of in this article I'm referencing here was called inhibitory control. So what is that, and how does that contribute to mental capacity?
Yeah, so inhibitory control is one of the ones that has been studied, and I withheld it in answering your last question because I knew this one. I knew this was coming. But it's a fancy term that basically just means restraint or focus. It's the ability when you want two or more different things simultaneously and you can't have both of them, your ability to choose the one you want the most and sort of push away, the ones that would be distractions from that overarching goal, that's inhibitory control. So an example I like to give is you want to lose 10 pounds and you want that delicious looking slice of German chocolate cake sitting in front of you. You can't have both. So you have to make a choice. And usually if it's like a deferred type of gratification, that calls on inhibitory control even more. So, the eating the cake will give you immediate satisfaction. Not eating the cake will only help you lose 10 pounds in long term. So it's not something that, dogs and monkeys are as good at as humans because of our more powerful and sophisticated brains, but not every human is really good at inhibitory control, sort of, resisting impulses and staying focused on the thing they want the most. Even if the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is at the end of a very long rainbow. So there have been a couple of recent studies showing that athletes who score high for inhibitory control perform better as endurance athletes. So 2 years ago, some Italian researchers did a test of inhibitory control on 30 ultra runners, and then they actually ran an ultra marathon, their scores for inhibitory control were highly predictive of how they would perform in an ultra marathon, which is just it's incredible because these tests. You're just sitting in your jeans and t-shirt in front of a computer. Like you're not being physically tested at all. It's just the main way they use the main test for this type of thing is called a Stroop test, which is very, if you've ever done it, you can actually do them online, but it doesn't require intelligence or anything. It's all about just staying focused and making choices, resisting distractions. Last year, Samuela Marcora, who wrote the foreword to my book, How Bad You Want It, he was involved in a test involving professional cyclists versus recreational cyclists. And he found that the pro cyclists scored better on this Stroop test. So like as a group, they had higher levels of inhibitory control. And then separately, he found that the pro cyclists their performance in a time trial was less negatively affected by mental fatigue. If you have pre-existing mental fatigue before a race or a time trial, you'll tend to perform worse because the parts of your brain that affect inhibitory control are sort of depleted by mental fatigue.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So actually in high school, I took the SAT and ran the state championship on the same day.
That's not a great idea.
Explains my performance. But anyhow, compared to the recreational cyclists, their performance in a time trial was impacted much more by pre-existing mental fatigue. And it's because the pros had, just greater resources of inhibitory control, a greater ability to stay focused, when the chips were down.
That makes complete sense. I'm thinking back to college when I'd have like a massive paper due before a race and it always, you just feel drained. I feel like that does... Obviously, it does. Evidence shows that really does affect your performance here. So kind of going off of that, Matt, does inhibitory control, you used the chocolate cake example, but when it comes to a race, is it really about just kind of getting through a rough patch, really just, buckling down and focusing and getting through that rough patch? Whereas if you have less inhibitory control, are you just less able to do that? Is that how it works?
In essence, the psychological situation you find yourself in during any type of endurance race is that One part of you wants to get to the finish line as quickly as possible. Another voice in your head wants you to quit or at least slow down, wants to you know, not bear the suffering that is required to get to the finish line as fast as possible. So that's just a fundamental contradiction. It's binary. It's like push as hard as you can or spare yourself the suffering. Like you can't have both. But, you know, if you're in a race, you are presented with that conundrum in every race. It just, there's no matter how mentally strong you are, there is a part of you that's not strong. I just want to suffer. So, you know, that's what it's all about. It's just, now, you know, you may get halfway through a race and decide, you know what, I really don't care. And that's fine. But if you do actually care, then you want to make the right choice, which requires that you stay focused on, you know, that sort of, that you repeatedly choose to keep pushing. So yeah, that's what's going on there. And obviously it is trainable. Some people are sort of naturals, you know, they have their sort of, they come out of the womb with some of this psychology in place. Yeah. But then there are athletes like me who have to develop it. You know, it did not come naturally to me. But you know, I worked at it and made a lot of progress.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So you mentioned the Stroop test. I will include a link to one I find online in the show notes here if anyone wants to try that test out for themselves. But you kind of had to develop this, you said, over a period of time. Do you have any tips for our listeners who want to increase their inhibitory control?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's various ways to do it. One, I mean, what worked for me first off was just intent. Like if you want to strengthen your mental game, it should be an explicit goal. Like a lot of athletes, they sort of, their goal is to PR, their goal is to, you know, get a ribbon or whatever. And they sort of know they have to get mentally stronger to achieve those goals, but they never make getting mentally stronger a goal in itself. Mm-hmm. And I did, you know, I went through a period when it's not that I didn't care about my times, but they were the second thing. Like when I finished a race and analyzed it and sort of graded it, I graded it on the basis of how much had I left out there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the performance was secondary. So the power of intent, you know, that gets you started down the road, and then you can kind of figure it out from there. That's what I did. But I mean, there are other tools that you can also employ. One of them is that, so inhibitory control is sort of transferable. So you can develop it in one part of life and then transfer it to another. So you can practice it outside of running, and then apply it to running. So if there's like a bad habit that you're trying to quit, you know, and you think, all right, well, that's a little bit easier. I think I can manage that a little bit more than just becoming a mental giant on the race course right off the bat. So it's sort of like the low hanging fruit approach. You just think of something in your life that will give you an opportunity to practice, you know, resisting temptations and, you know, choosing the thing that you really want most, and then sort of, you know, bootstrap your way to, you know, becoming, you know, well, having a greater capacity to focus that you can then transfer back to your running.
Okay. Interesting. So it really is just kind of like a process of baby steps, really just taking one small thing and then kind of adding to it. That's good to know. Okay. So going off of that, Matt, we've talked about inhibitory control, and later in this article I'm talking about, which again was called How Resilience Beats Talent, you said that while inhibitory control is incredibly important to mental capacity, at some point in your race, you know, the pain is going to overcome you. You can't really, you know, distract yourself from the pain entirely with inhibitory control. So with that being said, you think that the biggest contributing factor to mental capacity is resilience. So can you kind of talk to that a little bit? Why is this, and what makes an athlete resilient?
Yeah. So in the book, I talk about a number of coping skills, as I refer to them, as psychologists refer to them. So those are really, you know, when it comes down to it, those are the mental abilities you need to have to succeed as an endurance athlete. And you know, that term coping skill doesn't come from sports. It comes from general psychology, but you're the same person on the race course as you are off the race course. Mm-hmm. So, inhibitory control is just one of them. But the one I consider, you know, the mother of all coping skills is resilience. And, it's a term that's out there. A lot of people listening probably are familiar with it, but resilience really just refers to the ability to get back on the horse after you've been knocked off, just not giving up. Mm. So, you know, everybody fails, everybody gets knocked down, but the people who, you know, in the long term tend to achieve the most success in running and in other areas of life are those who don't quit. And so psychologists refer to that, that aptitude as resilience. Mm. And it's another one of those things that is partly innate. So some people are just, you know, born resilient, but it's clear that life experience trains resilience. Mm. You know, because think about it, like you can't have a strong capacity to overcome adversity if you've never experienced adversity.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So it's just like, you can't get stronger by thinking about lifting weights.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you got to lift them. And so you don't want to fail. You don't choose to fail, mm-hmm. but failure has a benefit in that regard, in that it does train resilience.
Okay, interesting. So, Matt, I was going to ask you how our listeners can work to improve their resiliency. It seems that the answer to that is kind of, you know, you kind of have to stumble a little bit to really build that resiliency up and practice bouncing back after setbacks. So what would your advice then be for listeners in terms of bouncing back after their setbacks and kind of picking themselves up and dusting themselves off again?
A few things. One is, you know, I recommend getting in the habit of taking risks and sort of viewing the challenges you set for yourself in those terms, because resilient people take risks, mm-hmm. and people who know they're not good at bouncing back don't put themselves out there. Mm. So it's one of those things where it can be scary, especially if you are a little more risk averse to start with, but then, you know, you put yourself out there and then you fail and you realize, well, that didn't kill me. You know, so that first time where you take a risk that just scares you, mm-hmm. and maybe you do fail, but then you're like, well, that didn't kill me. And people aren't laughing at me, whatever your worst fear was for the outcome. It's just like, you know, I could do this again. And then when you choose to take another risk, then you've got a little more momentum and you've begun a process of developing resilience. But there's also, in terms of like after the failure or after the setback, what really matters most is sort of how you process it psychologically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people who have low resilience, they tend to personalize their failures. So they'll say, I fail because I'm no good. Whereas someone who's more resilient will say, I failed because it was too hot. Or, you know, I failed just because I wasn't ready. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I failed because of correctable mistakes that I made. You know what I mean? So it's an explanatory style. Mm-hmm. So it requires a little bit of self-awareness. Like when you experience a failure, you need to not personalize it and also not, well, it's really catastrophizing. Like when people, it's like making a mountain out of a molehill. Mm. So, you know, they'll fail and they'll just make it bigger than it is. Yeah. Whereas, you know, someone who's more resilient will say, well, that was one race. That was one bad day. Mm-hmm. You know, big deal. So just in terms of like, just to throw more psychology jargon at you, the process is referred to as cognitive restructuring. Okay. So you can't change reality, but you can change how you frame it, how you look at it, how you interpret it, the meaning you ascribe to it. And that's really what you want to focus on. It begins with just awareness. So instead of just having a negative thought or personalizing a bad outcome or making it more pervasive than it needs to be, catch yourself doing that. Like, you know, it's okay to have a negative thought, but you can't just let it run the show. You need to sort of step back from yourself and say and sit and realize, wait a minute, I'm thinking about this in a really unhelpful way. And that gives you, you know, it's the whole knowledge is power thing. That awareness gives you a foothold, to start thinking about it in a different and more constructive way. It's not a matter of denying reality. Don't tell yourself it was hot if it wasn't really hot.
That's great though. I've been there. I've been, you know, kind of defeatist after bad races, and it does really, you have to kind of catch yourself on and realize that is so counterproductive. So I think, like you said, viewing bad races and setbacks as a learning moment is a great way to build up that resiliency. So kind of going off of that, Matt, earlier you were talking about how building up your mental capacity can compensate for, you know, if you aren't as physically capable as maybe somebody else. So going off of that, you have also mentioned in your book what is called biomechanical workarounds. And so you've talked about this a little bit in your book and the article I mentioned, but in a nutshell, it seems like these are where athletes can kind of develop things that compensate for physical limitations. So can you kind of talk about this a little bit and how that works?
Sure. You know, maybe a good example to familiarize people listening with these concepts is, I think we've probably all heard of, children who, for example, lose their sight early in life. They develop extraordinary hearing. Mm-hmm. And that's a function of what's known as neuroplasticity. So your brain is a lot more adaptable than the rest of your body is. So, you know, neurons that your brain might normally use to help you see can actually just be reassigned to other duties. Wow. If you lose your sight. So yeah. you become, you know, preternaturally good at hearing compared to other kids just by virtue of having lost your sight. So that's the sort of workaround I'm talking about.
Okay.
And these things can happen in athletics as well. You know, you could have, there are plenty of athletes, and in the book I give examples of, you know, Olympic champions or, you know, national champions who technically don't have the right body for their sport. So they're too tall or too short, too broad or too narrow. Whatever it is, their VO2 max isn't as high as it's supposed to be to be an Olympic champion. And yet you, there are many examples of athletes who sort of overcome these physical limitations by figuring out different ways to use their body. And also, an example of that type of athlete is Janet Evans, the mm-hmm. highly decorated swimmer who was just, I can't use that term, but very small compared to, like, she had the quote unquote wrong body for her sport because she was short and she had small feet. But she was just a determined little bugger when she was a swimmer, and she wanted to win. Another girl with her body who just didn't have that kind of drive might have thought, well, because, you know, the coaches told her, like, you're too small. Mm-hmm. And they she would have doors shut in her face. But she just, she had a will. So she developed, you know, this kind of windmill style technique. It was not the way any coach would have coached her to use her arms in, you know, freestyle swimming, but she figured it out, or, you know, her brain mostly just on a subconscious level, just figured out a more efficient way to swim that would overcome for being shorter than most, you know, elite swimmers are. So that's one example where you're sort of, you know, you just quote unquote have the wrong body for your sport and you find a way to make the best of it. Other examples that actually are a little bit more useful for every runner out there is when you have a setback that takes away some of your physical capacity, such as an injury or something like that, or even, you know, aging. Mm-hmm. And you have to find workarounds for those sorts of things. And so we all encounter those types of setbacks at some point or another, where, like, you know, the physical wherewithal that we've counted on to achieve our goals is suddenly diminished, you know, by injury or some other factor. And there are examples of workarounds for that. The one I focus on in the book is Serena Burla, the super successful American runner who, she was not a superstar in college. And then a couple of years out of college, she got cancer. And she had to have almost an entire hamstring muscle removed from her leg to get rid of a tumor.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thinking there is like, well, I mean, even her surgeon who took the muscle out said, he didn't tell her this, but privately thought, well, that's it for her professional running career.
Yeah.
But she didn't want to give up. So she started running again. And then she actually became a better runner, missing a hamstring muscle than she was before. And what's interesting is that the first time her coach didn't live in the same city she lived in. So the first time her coach saw her run, you know, sort of post-recovery, he noticed that her stride was completely different. So she had basically mostly on a subconscious level, her brain had found a different way to run. She had sort of reinvented running for her new body and did so in a way that made her better than she was. So unquestionably, physically losing the muscle was not a good thing. She did not get better because she lost the muscle. Mm-hmm. She lost physical capacity, but she more than made up for it just by this sort of biomechanical workaround effect.
After the break, Matt will share with us the importance of capitalizing on our strengths as individuals, as well as a few actionable tips on how we can sharpen our minds and push our limits. This is Sinead Honke, and you're listening to Run to the Top at Runners Connect. Nod with me if you've ever been in the middle of a training segment and had to miss a few days because you either got sick or work got busy or you had to travel. I can pretty much guarantee that all of you listening have experienced this before, and that's where having a coach becomes really valuable. When life throws you a few curveballs, we can adjust your workouts so you're not falling behind and not doing too much to try and catch back up. We also do everything we can to make sure you get the most out of every single workout. And that's just one of the awesome features our training plans have. We also build in strength workouts completely custom to your weaknesses, injuries, and goal race distance. Each workout you're assigned comes with in-depth instructions, and we of course build the training plan completely around you. No templates, no modifications needed on your end. Just a training plan written to your strengths and weaknesses and designed to help you achieve your goals. If you want to check it out, head on over to runnersconnect.net/train and start a free 2-week trial. We hope you join us. We are back with Matt Fitzgerald. And Matt, earlier you talked about these workarounds athletes can develop to compensate for physical limitations. And to me, this sounds like a matter of really taking advantage of your strengths. So going off that, Matt, do you have any tips for runners on how they can determine their strengths and then work to really capitalize on those strengths?
Yeah, well, you know, it takes sort of, it begins with belief. You know, like when you know, Janet Evans had belief. So even though she was like, I don't know, 6 years old when she started swimming and she had adults saying, you'll never amount to anything. You know, that's hard to overcome.
Yeah.
like you're not fully developed, you know, physically or psychologically. And yet she just had this belief. It's like, no, I can win. You know, I can find a way. She didn't know how she was going to win. That really just, it sort of has to happen on an unconscious level. But it really happens through experimentation. But the experiment won't happen unless you have belief. You know, Serena Burla, after cancer, after surgery, she thought, I don't care what my doctor thinks. Though he didn't discourage her, I should point out. He just had private thoughts. But, you know, she thought, you know, who knows? I could still be, you know, as good as I was before. So you have to have that mindset, you know. And from there, you just have to be open to exploration because – it's not a process you can consciously control. Like when you have to figure out like a way to become more efficient with reduced physical capacity, you can't just, you know, write out a bunch of formulas and then just go out and do that. It's like, oh, here's how I become here's how I reinvent my stride, you know, to make up for not having a hamstring muscle. Yeah. It doesn't work that way. But what you do is just try stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I give the example also in the book of one-arm Willie Stewart, who was a young man who lost an arm in a construction accident when he was only like 18 years old. And he was a rugby player then. And he sort of became depressed for a while and got out of shape, but then he got back into rugby with one arm.
Yeah.
And he became a better rugby player than he had ever been before, you know, just by, he developed new techniques, you know, just new ways to carry the ball, new ways to defend himself, new ways to tackle. But, you know, he couldn't have just sat in a chair and said, like, here's what I need to do. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He just like, you know, I'm going to give this a try. And then, you know, maybe the first and second and third thing he tried didn't work, but then he came up with something. And the reason he's in the book is that he became a triathlete and a runner later on. And so when he decided he wanted to do the Ironman with one arm, and, you know, the first time he swam, he practically drowned, you know, because like arms are really useful for swimming.
I would imagine so.
But same deal, like he had to like just kind of figure out like how to swim efficiently with one arm just through sort of trial and error. Mm. So it can be a little scary. Like when it's one thing, if like, you know what the solution is and you just have to work on it.
Yeah.
It's another, if you don't know what the solution is going to be. And then it just requires, you know, just belief and sort of an openness. It's just, you know, I'm just going to put myself out there and trust that eventually, you know, I'll figure it out, or my body and my brain we'll figure it out.
Absolutely. Yep. And it does take a process of trial and error. I think, like you said, I think that does apply to, and let me know if you agree, but maybe it applies to every individual has their own strengths depending on their speed, endurance, their mental capacity and so on. So I know for me personally, I have absolutely no fast twitch muscle whatsoever. I cannot run a mile to save my life, but I have more endurance capacity. So when I'm racing, I kind of try to capitalize on that. So does that kind of fall into it as well? Just really trying to pinpoint what you need to capitalize on in a certain race scenario?
Yeah, that's exactly true. And, you know, the formula for success in running is there's not one formula.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, people who are the experts on the genetics of endurance performance will tell you it's like there's no such thing as a genetically perfect runner.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so if you know, you take 10 women who can run a 2:30 marathon, genetically, they're all over the place. Like, yes, they're all going to be, you know, lean and have a high VO2 max, but like, the recipe is different. There's a funny tweet from Desiree Linden just today that I saw. She's in New York to run the marathon. I guess she was in Central Park. She was in Central Park doing strides, and she passed by Shalane Flanagan, she says she had this kind of moment of embarrassment because like Shalane is really, really fast, and Des, who's arguably just as good at the marathon, is not really that fast. And she, you know, so Shalane's just flying and Des is like, I feel like a hippopotamus here. And yet, she said she just laughed because, you know, a less confident person, they would let that get to them. Mm. It's like, oh, I can't be as good as Shalane if I don't have the top end speed. Desiree doesn't believe that. She believes exactly. She has the mindset you have. It's like, well, I've got something else, you know, to make up for that. And, and that's true of everyone, you know, at every level of the sport, you have strengths and weaknesses and you'll get the most out of yourself overall if you do focus on your strengths. I mean, you have to shore up your weaknesses, but you can't, I mean, if you don't have fast twitch, you're never going to be, you know, it's just whatever, just.
As much as I would love to be a 100-meter specialist, it's not going to happen. So, I like that philosophy a lot. And it kind of leads me to my next question, which I feel like when you capitalize on those strengths, you're better able to reach your physical limit. So going off of that, you have also written a little bit about how bracing yourself for a workout or a race can actually boost your performance by up to 15%, you said in your book. So can you kind of talk about that a little bit as well? How can listeners achieve that?
Right. So, you know, obviously we've talked a lot about what you do, what happens inside your head during a race, but also what happens inside your head before a race or workout, as you suggest, matters. And there are two, I mean, it's more complicated than this, but one aspect of it, there's kind of two orientations you can have about an upcoming experience that you know is going to be unpleasant in some way. And every race is or should be.
You're doing it right.
And, you know, one is that you sort of accept it. You know, I know it's coming, and hey, that's just part of it. As some famous middle distance runner said decades ago, it's just pain. Yep. So that's one attitude. The other attitude is you can sort of try to deny it or resist it. So, you know, your thinking might be, boy, I hope this is one of those races that, you know, you just feel great the whole way and you still are like, okay, that's a little bit of magical thinking. And, you know, those races do happen, but not very often. So what the research shows is that you're the first attitude, sort of accepting the pain, which almost sounds pessimistic a little bit. It's like, man, this is really going to hurt. Yeah. But it actually helps you perform better, because the more pain or discomfort you expect to feel and accept, the more you'll actually be able to handle, and your performance in a race is going to be determined in part by how much you're willing to suffer. And you just will be willing to suffer more if ahead of time you've quote unquote, you know, braced yourself for it and said, hey, I know it's coming, part of the sport, no big deal. Yeah. Versus like, you know, just saying this is, you know, just kind of living in a fantasy world where it's like, I just hope I'm just riding on a magic carpet for 26.2 miles.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And so there's a really cool study that I mentioned in the book that it was done in 2014 by a woman named Elena Ivanova, where she took non-athletes and she subjected them to like one of these high intensity endurance bouts to exhaustion. So they get on stationary bikes and ride at like 85% of VO2 max until they fall off.
Oh, sounds like a good time.
But this is how they do this type of study. So they did it like, you know, a few weeks apart. And these were non-exercisers, non-athletes. Yeah. So they didn't do physical training between the first test and the repetition of the same test a couple of weeks later. But some of them were subjected to what's called acceptance and commitment therapy, which is basically just training in this bracing yourself. Just instead of wishing it wouldn't hurt, just accepting that it will. Their performance, so they lasted, I think it was actually 55% longer in this endurance ride to exhaustion, the ones who had this training with no physical exercise. It is an endurance test, and they got way better at it just because of what they were taught to think before they did it. Whereas the control group, they just watched like documentary films as like, you know, just an alternative to this therapy. Of course, they didn't improve at all. So it's just amazing. Wow. You know, just like obviously workouts help, but, you know, quite apart from workouts, you know, things you can do to train your mind and your thought patterns will also perform better.
That's amazing. So when you're kind of talking about maybe implementing this into a runner's schedule, should they do this kind of bracing period, maybe an hour before their race? Should they do it more frequently than that even? How should they incorporate that into their lifestyle?
Well, you know, I can't speak to how it's done like in a clinical environment, like what, you know, this acceptance therapy that Dr. Ivanova did. I don't know the details of that, but it's, you know, the way I use it is just, you know, I think once you understand the concept and the value of it, it can happen just kind of organically. Mm-hmm. Like when you have a race coming, you will find yourself anticipating the discomfort. It's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So it's just when you have those moments when you're thinking, I remember, I ran the Chicago Marathon a few weeks ago.
Oh, and, nice. Okay.
Yeah. So there was, one of the professional female professional runners in the field, a woman named Sarah Crouch. I saw her before the race.
Sarah's one of my best friends.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
So you know how awesome Sarah is.
Yeah,
so anyway,
yeah.
But it's funny, I saw her, it was sort of like a gallows humor type of thing, because she's very mentally tough. I mean, very.
Yeah, for sure.
But I, you know, I saw her before the race, and she's like, she just kind of joked, you know, 9 weeks ago, this seemed like a great idea. But that's what happens. I mean, it's so normal. You know, you get close to it, and you're like, you know, 9 weeks out from a marathon, you're like, I'm going to PR.
Oh, yeah.
But then as it gets close, you're like, oh, geez, I've kind of set the bar high for myself.
Starts to sink in a little bit.
Right. So if it happens to Sarah Crouch, it happens to everyone. And so just when it happens, you just, it's one of those things where you take a step back from yourself and say, like, you know what? It is going to hurt. Mm-hmm. And I do accept it. I've been there before. It's not going to kill me. I don't necessarily love it, but you know, I'm going to take it as it comes.
Yeah.
versus like just trying to push it out of your head and pretend like it's not going to happen, because then it will sort of surprise you. Mm-hmm. And you don't want that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sarah, she's great, as you know, and, she's definitely handed my head to me a few times in workouts. I know she is very, very mentally strong. Definitely kind of benefited, knowing her and kind of learning from her. But she's awesome. So, Matt, really, this is kind of my last question for you today. And it does kind of go off of what we've been talking about in terms of pushing that physical limit. So in your book, you also argue that runners need to, in order to improve, they need to change the way they perceive effort. So can you kind of talk about why that's important and how runners can alter their perception in order to improve?
Yeah, so perception of effort is a critical concept in, you know, the psychology of endurance performance. And it just refers to, sort of in a global sense, how hard you feel you're working at any given moment when you're running. And there's an abundance of research now showing that it is in fact really perception of effort that directly limits endurance performance. So obviously you have physical limits, but you're never able, in any type of true endurance race, you're never able to run to the point of an actual physical breakdown. So in theory, any of the things physically that could stop you, they don't actually happen in an endurance race, because you encounter a psychological limit first, which is your maximum tolerance for perception of effort. So basically, if you feel you can't run any faster, you can't run any faster, even if physically you could. So that's your limiter. So the thing about perception of effort, though, is that it is mutable to a certain degree. So you can, what feels like your limit today might no longer feel like your limit tomorrow, even if you haven't gotten any fitter, you know, even if physically you're no longer better. So there's a little bit of room to play with there. So what you want to do as a runner is sort of close the distance between that psychological limit and your true absolute physical limit, which you'll never get to.
Yeah.
And there's a million different ways to do that. Some of the research, sort of the space age stuff that's proving that this reserve capacity actually exists. There have been studies done, including a very recent one involving actual endurance athletes rather than just college students or whatever. But what they'll do is they'll zap your brain with electromagnetic energy and then have you do a time trial and you go faster.
Oh my gosh! Wow.
So you'll do two time trials. One, you just get on the bike and go, and another one, you have your brain zapped first and you go faster after you have your brain zapped.
Well, gosh, wow.
That's proof that when you did the time trial without having your brain zapped, you could have gone faster.
You just
couldn't.
That's crazy. Wow. Very interesting.
It simply works by making the same intensity of exercise feel a little bit easier. Mm. And if it feels a little bit easier, you can do it longer, or you could go the same distance a little bit faster. So there's, you know, a lot there. I understand that, especially the athletes out there who like to think of themselves as really mentally tough, they don't want to believe they have reserve capacity at the end of the race, but you just do.
Yeah. It's called self-preservation, probably.
It might be a topic for another day, but there are a lot of ways that you can sort of change your relationship to perception of effort. And there are things that you definitely want to work on in order to become a better runner.
Absolutely. Well, Matt, I know we could talk about this probably for hours, and really, I feel like we've packed quite a bit into this interview. Really do appreciate you coming on to talk about this, but I've learned so much during this, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. Thank you so much for coming and sitting down with us today.
You bet. My pleasure.
Running is one of, if not the most mentally difficult sport out there, and I don't think too many people would argue against that. Fortunately, like Matt said, you can increase your mental resilience the same way you can increase your speed and endurance through training. If you liked today's interview and want to hear more on how you can train your mind, be sure to check out our upcoming mental training summit at runnersconnect.net/mental summit. It's going to be a weekend jam-packed with insight from some of running's most renowned psychologists, authors, and athletes. So you really don't want to miss this. And if you're listening to this after November 2017, don't worry, you can still check out the archived summit at the same link, runnersconnect.net/mental summit. Before I sign off, I just want to announce the winners for our last Run to the Top giveaway. Congratulations to Kim Baer of Geneva, Indiana, and Michael Nance of Columbia, South Carolina. Kim and Michael each won a signed copy of Jonathan Beverly's newest book, Run Strong, Stay Hungry. I finished this book a couple weeks ago, and it is such an amazing read. Kim and Michael, I really think you're going to enjoy it. Congratulations again, Kim and Michael, and happy reading. If you didn't win this time, don't worry, there will be plenty more giveaways where that came from. In fact, thanks to Matt Fitzgerald, we have another giveaway going right now. Matt was generous enough to offer one lucky winner a copy of his book, How Bad Do You Want It? And the contest will run now through our Mental Training Summit and end at midnight Eastern on November 25th, 2017. So be sure to get your name in fast. And if you want to keep up to date with our giveaways and the general goings-on at Run to the Top, you can join the Run to the Top Winner Circle at runnersconnect.net/winner. This is a Facebook group where you can chat with fellow listeners and myself about the show, your training, whatever you like. You can also give me feedback to help me make the show better and better, which I really can't thank you enough for. I'd love to see you there. One last thing before we wrap this up. If you enjoyed this episode or you're a big fan of Run to the Top in general, a 5-star rating and review on iTunes goes such a long way and helps us way more than you might know. The more 5-star ratings we get, the better we can reach runners like yourself and provide them with some insight that helps them out with their running. So if you have a couple minutes to spare and want to show us some love, I really appreciate it. And to those of you who have already done so, thank you so much. Reading your comments honestly makes my day. Seriously, I'm not joking. Whenever one of your comments pops up, it's just so gratifying to see that the podcast is being enjoyed and that it's helping your running in some way. I really do love seeing that, so thank you so much again. I think that just about does it today, but thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you do so again next time. Until then, have an amazing week.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from runnersconnect.net.